Here we go. Scott Payne, I appreciate you doing this, man.
Thanks for having me, buddy.
Well, last time I heard that sexy voice, you and I were at an undisclosed location in a bathroom. So thank God this is a little better than hanging outside of a bathroom, right, bro?
That's funny because the publicist really keeps me straight. So he's like, all I got to do is go to the Pale Horse book tour thing. And he has like, this is your next one, this is your next one. And there'll be a notes section. And it's like, hey, this show does a lot on mental health and blah, blah, blah. And on your notes section, it's like, hey, he's a detective and y'all met in the bathroom. And I'm like, oh, I know who that is. Yeah, cool.
Well, let's do it. Best-selling author now, codename Pale Horse, How I Went Undercover to Expose America's Nazis. Have you ever seen anyone reading your book in public yet?
Ooh, yes, yes. A couple of days before I met you, I spoke at the NYPD. It was the Cybercrime Counterterrorism Conference.
Okay.
So I walk in, and I'm running late because I was coming from Jersey because I did another podcast, and I'm running in. I'm pulling the suitcase. I go in, and they took like a 10-minute break, and I'm like, cool. So they're wiring me up, and the guy wiring me up, I turn and I look, and I see this familiar face, but I'm running so late. I go, hey, how's it going, buddy? And then I look, and I go, oh, hell, you don't know me. It was Colin, I'm gonna screw up his last name. No, not Yost. It's the other Colin from Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
He had like the MTV show.
Colin Quinn.
So I look at him and I go, well, hell, you don't know me. I go, hey, how you doing? Sorry, I didn't recognize. I said, how you doing? So the guy's wiring me up and somebody says something about me and the covert stuff. And the guy wiring me up, he's like, hey, you know, you need to check out this. There's a guy that was on Joe Rogan. He's got this Southern accent. He was an undercover. And I look at him and I go, dude, that's me. And he's like, he goes, oh, holy shit, it is you. So we're talking. Colin comes up and he goes, am I reading your book right now? And I'm like, I don't know. Are you? And he shows me his phone and I look and I go, yep. He was in like chapter 4. I go, yeah, that's my book.
That's cool shit, bro.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
So you're big country, big text, this big dude, alpha male, crazy stories. You're a girl dad. Let me know The last time the girls made you melt or do something that you're like, holy shit, bro, if my boy saw me now, man. Because you're this big dude. People see like, oh, shit, that's big country, man. Last time your girls made you do something, you're like, bro, if the guy saw me now.
It's all the time. Anytime they succeed and they're older now, but – yeah, anytime they succeed or like this whole thing, like I've been on the road nonstop for 3 months at least. And some of the times my wife does, she traveling wears her out. But I'll take one of my daughters. I'm like, hey, are you in town? Hey, you want to go with me to Nashville? Absolutely. Hey, you want to go with me to San Diego? Yeah. You want to go to Vegas? So it's really cool to see them in that environment. But I'll say this, like when I did Joe Rogan, it was my youngest daughter and my wife went with me. Of course, they didn't get to go on set. I mean, it's Joe Rogan. But people ask me, they go, man, what was the coolest experience of that whole week you were in Austin? I said, the coolest experience? They're like, yeah. I said, watching my wife and daughter. They were like rock stars. They're like, actually, they were out buying stuff as if we'd already received a check. And I'm like, hey.
Let him post the podcast first like, and let him sell some books.
There's no checks coming in yet. Y'all need to slow down. But I'm like, all right, go ahead. But yeah, I mean, they're both of them are hardworking, successful. Although I do help still supplement their stuff because everything's so dad blasted expensive. I'm like, I can't hate on them. They're doing the best they can. I mean, they're working their tails off, but everything's so expensive. But yeah, I mean, anything they do to succeed. I mean, like my youngest daughter, I'm a musician and singer. She'll sing with me. They're very, I don't want to say they're fearless, but man, they'll just go out and they're like, you know what? I'm going to join this thing. And it starts in 6 days and I got to fly to Kona, Hawaii. And I'm like, there's no way you can, I'm like, there's no way. You just signed a lease on an apartment. There's no way you can get out of it. Bro, 6 days later, out of the lease.
Insane.
On a plane. To go to Kona, Hawaii to be trained as a disciple missionary, then does 2 to 3 months in Papua New Guinea, comes back. I'm like, what in the heck is going on? But yeah, anything they do to succeed. When they're happy and you see them glowing, that glow, You know, it's always heartwarming for me. And yeah, I'll tear up. Oh my gosh, I'm a rom-com guy, man. I cry at the rom-coms, man. So, you know.
I'm glad you mentioned Rogan because your stories were told on Rogan, and that's what put you on everyone's radar. So, is it cool if we don't rehash those same stories? Because listen, go back to Rogan. The whole world's listened to it. Over 3 or 4 million people. I want to know about the young Scott Payne growing up. Where'd you grow up?
Greenville, South Carolina. It's
Sports
up in the
guy or no?
mountains. Yeah. I played basketball. The longest I played was football, but
Okay.
basketball, baseball. I wrestled for a little bit. That's one do-over I'd like to do. I'm not a guy that looks back on my life and says, "Man, I'd do this different." I definitely would have started wrestling my freshman year in high school.
And any offers going, college or not really, kind of ended
No,
after high
I
school.
played. I played D1 ball at Charleston Southern
Oh
in South
shit, okay.
Carolina. Yeah, I was a lineman. I was back. I think I got up to about 295, maybe. If I'd had another year, I could have busted 300. But, whew, I don't have
Now,
big calves. If I look at my buddies with big calves, and I'm like, if I had one of your calves, I'd be like 280 again. But I'm not 280 anymore.
here's the important question. You live in Tennessee now, South
Yep.
Carolina guy. Where's your loyalty? Because I'm a Kentucky basketball fan, so I'm not a big
Oh.
fan of other SEC teams. So you a Tennessee guy or South Carolina guy?
Man, see, I just love sports.
All right.
I don't know if I have a team. Of course, I'm probably going to go not University of South Carolina. I was a Clemson
Okay.
guy. Actually, you know what? I was forced to be a Clemson guy growing up. Everybody got me when I was a kid. I'd get for Christmas, it'd be like Clemson, Clemson, Clemson. I'm like, well, nobody ever asked me what I wanted, so I started wearing Gamecock stuff. You know, arch rivals, and they're like, "Whoa, what are you doing? What are you doing?" But I got good friends. I mean, they love South Carolina. Their daughter just graduated from there. She's basically my niece. We're not blood relatives, but that's Uncle Joe and I'm Uncle Scott. My stepdad graduated from Clemson. I got a lot of friends from
Oh
there.
shit, okay.
But yeah, I played at Charleston Southern. And basketball. Well, you know what? I got a good buddy. He's the SWAT team leader in Manchester, New Hampshire. And we just put on, what's today? So 2 weeks ago, we ran two alert classes in Kentucky, but it was right. I mean, it's Kentucky, Ohio, West Virginia. It's all right there. And we stopped off at the University of Kentucky to see WWE SmackDown that Friday night coming in.
My
So
man.
yeah. So I was in whatever that
Rupp Arena.
Rupp Arena. Yeah, I
The
was in
Holy
there.
Grail, baby.
I was backstage with some friends at WWE.
That's sick.
Yeah.
You're traveling the world, traveling the country now. You're a Tennessee guy known for their food. What food do you miss the most when traveling? You're like, all right, I'm in New York, I'm here, but I want to get back to Tennessee to eat what?
Oh man, does Tennessee have like a solid?
Like New York, we got pizza and
No,
bagels.
I
That's our
know.
thing.
No, I mean Italian food,
Of
period, man. We
course.
went to what? We went to Tony D something.
Tony didn't, in Little Italy on Mulberry Street?
I don't know. There's two
Okay.
of them.
All right, all right.
But it was the crew at NYPD that took us out there. I mean, we all pitched in money, but
Yeah.
man, I don't think I can ever have mozzarella. And I'm like, this is like really good stuff. This is really good stuff. And I don't know. I mean, they might say like a barbecue or something, but like that's more Memphis. If you get to
Yeah.
Memphis, you know, and that's the flatland, cotton fields. But that's a good question. Kind of caught me off guard because I'm trying to think of what's known for
I was
Knoxville.
thinking, like, is hot chicken, would that be something down there or not really?
No.
No, okay.
No, now if you said South Carolina, I would say vinegar-based barbecue, mustard-based barbecue. So that's a big thing in South Carolina, but I don't know actually if we got anything in Knoxville. I'm gonna have to
Well,
do my homework.
yeah, when we finish up, you got to give me a food so I know. Doing all these podcasts, doing Rogan, doing Dax, doing everything, you're reliving the stories over and over. Therapeutic for you? Is it difficult to relive it? Because some of the stories, as a listener, you're like, oh shit, that's dope. Or, but you're not put in the situation that many law enforcement are. Is it tough to relive those situations?
Not so much now because I've
Okay.
been trained even before I retired and I got this book deal and I've been blessed with all this stuff. I taught these blocks of instruction. I still do. Like
Yeah.
I matter of fact, in a couple of weeks I'll be at the Georgia Gang Investigators Association, and I'll do the 3 year period of the, and when I'm in Outlaws and the, getting stripped in the basement and then crashing mentally and physically. I'll hit all that stuff for that. So in the beginning, yeah, in the beginning, it was actually a little bit PTSD-ish, you know, to talk about it. And sometimes when I'm talking about it, like especially live to a crowd and I'm showing a video or something, sometimes I tear up, you know, and I talk about the hard times with my wife and stuff like that. Doing the book was a little tough to dive into those dark areas because we had to go back into a time in our life when things weren't that great. But I wanted to be vulnerable and transparent because I think that's the best way to teach and for people to learn and to, you know, that's just the way I am. I'm just transparent.
Opening up with the book, doing the book, how'd the idea come from? Because here we go. We have a great story at a bar. Everyone's like, oh, shit, bro, you need to write a book. And we're like, all right, bro, we'll go write a book. You went through with it. Now, your stories are nuts. What made you take that final step to write the book?
They beat me down. I was like, all right, all right. Now, I'll tell you what happened. I never wanted to do the Rolling Stones article. I never wanted to do a book. I had friends, and I already mentioned wrestling. Actually, this whole thing starts because of professional wrestling. That's how this whole thing
like started. Like old stories do.
Yeah. It's Glenn Jacobs is my mayor.
Oh, Shane. Of course,
yeah,
Kane.
Yeah. So he's a buddy of mine. You know what? Oddly enough, here it is, bro. Today is June 30th in Knox County, Tennessee. It is exactly 4 years to the day that I retired. I retired June 30th of 2021. Glenn came to my retirement party and declared it Scott Payne Day.
No shit.
Today is Scott Payne Day.
Congratulations, bro. That's wild, isn't it?
I don't know what it means. I got
it sounds cool as fuck.
I can show you. Like right over there is where the thing is, where he signed it. That's the proclamation. I'm like, I don't get it, but hey, you know. So I knew that I wanted to get involved in the industry a little bit. I'm a musician and a singer, so I'm very familiar with the music industry. I'm very familiar with the professional wrestling industry. So entertainment's very similar. You know, people will come in, they might buy your stuff, they might option it, and it never gets played.
Yeah.
Some of the best songs that have ever been written, nobody will ever hear, you know? But I had friends, and it all started with Glenn when he was running. I hadn't met him personally, but he's in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And I had so many contacts in WWE back then, it was way easier. But my kids got to grow up backstage. We would get to go to catering and I would bring kids from church or people that didn't have money, you know, that I'd be like, look, here's the rules. We get to go in and hang out at catering. You get to go get food. We're going to sit at this table. Don't stare at them. Don't talk to them. If they want to talk to us, they'll come up to us. This is their sanctum. This is, and a lot of times they would be coming back from their Europe tour. So you got 2 weeks in Europe. So you got SmackDown and Raw rosters. And their first stop is in Tennessee. So they're worn out. But then through time, I meet more people. And I met Glenn.
Wow.
And when he was running, I would be at his events and maybe not on the books, but I might help with a little crowd control or something like that. And we got to know each other. And when he became mayor, the guy that helped run his campaign is now a very good friend of mine. But that's where we met. That guy ended up going into the film and TV and unscripted documentary realm. And it started with them recruiting my oldest daughter. He came up and he said, hey, has your daughter ever been asked to do casting calls or modeling? And I'm like, no. Why? What does that entail? Because I'm like, I know that world. There ain't going to be no Harvey Weinstein shit.
No.
I'm like.
And the balls to ask you that, Scott. You know, like, hey,
Yeah, I know. But I'm like, you know. But then we get to know each other. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, holy shit. And then they're like friends with, you know, Rob Schneider and all these other things. And then it's like, hey, you need to meet these people. And then one thing leads to another. You meet somebody and they're like, after two nights of drinking, they're like, man, they get back to LA and they're telling me I had to download Zoom at that point because I didn't even have it. And he's like, hey, I know, a Neanderthal. And he's like, even if this doesn't work out between us and this thing we got working on, there are people in LA that you need to meet and people or Hollywood that you need to meet and they need to meet you. And then it goes on to something else. And then I ended up getting the Rolling Stones article because apparently you need IP, which is intellectual property. And I didn't know what none of that meant. And then that takes off. And then that's when the literary agents were calling Rolling Stone magazine and saying, we want to talk to Scott. We want to talk to Scott. That journalist is very persuasive. And he kept telling me, I'm like, I don't want to do a book, man. That's just not, I don't see that in my future. I don't see me running around to different towns on radio shows and doing this, that, and the other. And he was very persuasive, as I said. And I finally got on. I think I talked to two or three different literary agents. Mm-hmm. And it's a couple, Sasha and Larry. They're Brooklyn Literary. They're right there in the five boroughs. And they sold me. They were like, look, this is a great story. And then as they were talking, they said, you know, we've done other retired FBI undercovers. And I'm like, who? And they were like, it was the art theft book. I'm like, Bob? Bob Whitman? They're like, yeah. And I go, you still in contact with him? And they said, yes. I said, give him my number, tell him it's Big Country. And Bob called me the next day and we talked for 2 hours. And he said, Country, you can't do any better. And they sold me on really the way it started was all I'm doing is telling my stories, just like I'm teaching a block at a gang conference or an NYPD conference. And whether it's the national white nationalism side, like the neo-Nazi side, yeah. And I'll take you from KKK all the way up to, you know, the current stuff that's out there now, or biker stuff, or it could just be a day of undercover blocks and working with sources and not working with sources, how to approach and things like that. And I'm basically going to be doing that with a co-writer, and they're going to put it into a written form. And that's how it started. And then it started becoming, what do you want this book to say? And then it became, now let's dive back into those bad times with your wife. Let's talk about that. And I'm like, oh, but I'm very, very blessed and happy and grateful and thankful and all those things that I did it. Cause it's been cool.
It was a different type of book to read. Cause it wasn't just police, police, police. I'm the hero. I do cool shit. You went through high school stuff to the rocky relationships of marriage. You went in, it was such a different type of book and it was so refreshing. Cause I don't like to read a lot of law enforcement books, but yeah. People recommended it to me and I'm like, holy shit, it was so different. Did you know, getting into it, well, you know what? I want this to be a little different. I really want to open up. Is that something you wanted to do?
Kind of. That's a great question. What I did is I already had several undercover retired agents books, like whether it's ATF or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there were things I liked and things I didn't like. I started writing down what I didn't like, you know. I hate it when it says, like, I'm an undercover and I've been more undercovers than anybody, 30 years undercover, and it takes you to chapter 10 to talk about undercover. And yeah. It wasn't even really you undercover. I'm like, what the hell? This is like, it's like false advertising. So I said, absolutely not. So that first chapter is just an overview, quick overview of me growing mm-hmm. up. You get to hear about me going a little satanic stuff there for a little bit. But then it's like High School Confidential. What did I consider my first undercover? And even though it wasn't in a fake name.
Yeah, that was funny.
Like, that's the first time I started like using my skill set of connecting with all types of people to find out information of who vandalized
the car.
Vandalized my vice principal's house and car. So yeah, man, it was, so I looked at those and also my friend and mentor, Jack Garcia, he was FBI New York, mm-hmm. Pretty much worked full time undercover, which is rare. And his book is, The Making of Jack Falcone. And I leaned on him heavily. And that is actually my wife read the books as well. Her favorite book is Jack Garcia. And what a lot of people don't know is me and my co-writer put together the first three chapters. And
no, we're like, really?
Yeah. Well, we wrote the first three chapters and we're like, man, this is solid. And I let my wife read it. And she came back and she goes, this sucks. And I'm like, what do you mean it sucks? And she's like, well, in Jack's book and blah, 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 blah. And I started looking at it. I go, holy shit, I'm writing it like it's a damn law enforcement report.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just the facts, no speculating, no nothing. And the journalist, my co-writer, says, holy shit, I'm writing it like I'm out in the field doing journalism. So we're like, let's rewind, mm-hmm. let's slow this thing down, and let's try to let the reader feel like they're in the moment. And that's then it started clicking. And from there, it was, I think, in 6 months or a little over 6 months, we had the book knocked out.
Cops are relentless. Do you get fucked around with now that you're the studious guy? Oh, there's the author. Scott's the author now. You get fucked around with a lot or not from the old dudes?
Yeah. Well, Joe Pistone is a mentor and friend of mine. And,
oh, wow.
And he texts me and he goes, Country, how in the hell did you land Joe Rogan? And I go, boss man, I have no freaking idea. And I said, and by the way, when you hear them call me the hillbilly Donnie Brasco, I never, ever said that shit. There's no way in hell I would even try to take anything from you. I said, but they're calling me that. All I can tell you is I'm going to do the best I can. And he sent me back the cool emoji with the sunglasses. And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I like it. And I'm like, well, if the boss man says he likes it, I guess it's in there. So,
patrol in South Carolina, one or two man teams. You solo patrol down there when you first?
Solo. Yeah. Never had a partner.
What type of jobs is it now? Very different. I'm up here in Brooklyn, worked in Manhattan, South Carolina, Greenville, I believe, if I'm not correct. What kind of jobs you do in the first couple of years as a rookie? Just regular domestic calls, accidents? What kind of jobs down
Everything.
there?
Yeah,
Okay.
everything. So, uniform patrol, you respond to everything. I'd say the main difference between my sheriff's office and a lot of sheriff's offices, you didn't have to start out at the jail. And then they allowed us to do our own follow-up investigations to a certain, like a monetary amount
I
or a
love
certain
that. Yeah.
level, which, I mean, yeah, it was awesome because you're already starting to work on your
And you're
investigative
invested now.
skills. You go back and you're like, hey, I got to learn how to do a follow-up investigation. I got to call back. I got to find this out. So yeah, that was awesome. And then I made vice narc. I was uniformed for 3 years. I went to Northern Command Narcotics, and then there was a snafu there with the supervisor, and he tried to screw me. Luckily, I didn't know I was doing it. But I've always been a good note taker and documentation, and that saved my ass. But I did go back to uniform for about 2 months, and then I went to Southern Command Narcotics, and that's where I was at till I retired.
Let me ask you
Till
that,
at the sheriff's office.
Scott, you're known as, and many cops do this. We can tell you where we were, what we were wearing, time of the day, the first time we got a key or a gun or kicked in a door. Now, rewind, I want you to be honest with me. Worst arrest. I want an arrest. You started off, you're sitting in there, you're like, holy shit, did I really make this fucking arrest? Like an embarrassing arrest. Because everything you tell is cool shit. Give me an early arrest you made was like, did I really arrest someone for this, man?
That's a damn good question because there's something that's jumping out to me because I'm
All right.
thinking like worst arrest, like I shouldn't have done, or
No,
I got you.
like just that you're sitting there and your boys are like, yo, you know Scott's a cop, bro. He must be doing cool shit. And you're like, nah, bro, what I really fucking did was this. Give me a sh
Oh,
embarrassing
like a
arrest.
shitty one. Oh man, there's probably a ton of those, but I'm gonna tell you what jumped out to me.
All right.
Post OJ Simpson, it
Okay.
now becomes mandatory to arrest because before the OJ Simpson, we would go and if it was like mutual combatants kind of thing, we'd be like, okay, hey, well, here's your, I take a statement. All right, here's your case number. Go to the magistrate and you got to follow up. But after OJ Simpson, it was like, okay, if you see any evidence of abuse, now the state's the victim and we can go ahead and arrest, mandatory
Someone
arrest.
got to go, yeah.
Yeah, so I went and interviewed a woman and she's like, look at the marks on me and this is what he did. I take a statement, I go get a warrant. I'm like, all right, I'm going to pick this dude up. She tells me, and it's in the statement, he chased her around the house, he beat her. I've got pictures of the wounds and stuff, and he did this, and it was all like he's running after her and all this stuff. I show up with a warrant to arrest the guy. He doesn't have any legs. And I'm like, maybe I should have come over and talked to him as well. Because this could be a mutual combatants thing. And he had claw marks on
No,
him. I'm like,
no.
oh shit. Because I went in the house and he's like, hang on, let me put my legs on, basically. And I'm talking from the hip down, prosthetic. And I'm sitting here thinking, and we went to trial. We went to trial, and I'm not saying he didn't deserve to go to jail.
Of course.
I'm not saying she should have, but it went to trial, and I had to go up there and testify. And I'm like, and we won. He went to jail, and but I'm like, that one, I was like, oh, damn. I'm like, ah, it's kind of hard to paint this picture. You know? But yeah. Like he chased her down, ran up her back. I don't know. It was terrible. Terrible.
You told great stories about your first undercover buys in Greenville, how you're doing undercover, the little sales. The question I always wanted to ask you was, you were doing undercover in South Carolina, and a lot of times, and I don't know if it's different in smaller agencies, not saying yours was, we'll join JTTF, Joint Terrorist Task Force, but you actually resigned from South Carolina and then went and joined the FBI. It's kind of a different route that I'm used to that I see. Did you want to go a federal route, ATF, DEA, FBI? What made you resign from South Carolina to go the FBI route?
It's really weird, man, because I didn't think I was forward thinking.
Okay.
I thought it happened like later on in my career at the sheriff's office, but digging through, like you move and you find that one bin that's got all your law enforcement stuff in it. I still had the raincoat and man, it had water on it. There was mold everywhere. I had my yearbooks in there. I'm like, damn, I'm spraying it down with Clorox and stuff. Anyway, I found somewhere I'd written, I'm going to be a federal agent in 5 years. I don't know where I wrote it. I don't remember writing it,
Wow.
but I'll tell you what I do remember is that the big thing for us was, at least where my mindset was, is where are you going to be in 5 years? So I'm 5 years at the sheriff's office. I'm a two-striper. I'm making nothing. And county council every year would give themselves a raise, but they wouldn't raise our pay. They would raise the hiring rate. So it got so asinine that I literally at one point could have quit the sheriff's office, walked back in with a 4-year degree, and made as much or more than I was making as a two striper. And you're like, and you will never, you would never, I mean, you would be capped out. You would have to be, you'd be forced to retire and not even be close to maxing out. So we started going in protest in uniform and standing at the county council, bringing the news, and that put the pressure on them. And they started giving us our raises. But I looked at the federal government and I'm like, okay, as long as I don't screw up and get fired, which is in the FBI, as long as you don't lie, I mean, there's some pretty bad stuff that have, you see the quarterly report from, it's our internal affairs. It's
Personal
response, OPR. I call it Oprah, the OPR. I mean, there's some insane stuff that happens, but as long as you don't lie about it, you might get demoted. You might get 30 days on the bricks, but you're not getting fired. And I said, in 5 years, I'd be a GS-13. And it was my sergeant that put those thoughts in my head. And he was a former Marine, Popeye forearms, Fu Manchu, looked like a bulldog, had the tattoo of the bulldog, Semper Fi. And we were on a surveillance one day, and he's like, my nickname on that squad that was Southern Command was Kingpin. He said, Kingpin, if I was a young man like you, single, and I had a 4-year degree, I'd apply to be an FBI agent. I'd put New York City as my first office. And I was like, what in the hell are you talking about? And I really only thought FBI kind of worked mainly bank robberies because that's the only time I saw them.
Yeah.
I might see one on a big roundup, and we would laugh because you know the roundups where you show up at the empty parking lot at like 4 in the morning.
Yep.
And everybody's got, and there's one dude over there with a glaring, glowing in the dark FBI hat, FBI jacket, FBI whatever. He walks up and does the badge. Hey, FBI Special Agent so-and-so. I'm like, no shit. I saw that from 100 yards away, you know? I applied because I was told it was the hardest to get accepted by. So I applied with him first, and man, I never got a chance to fill anything else out. When I went through Quantico, that's back when DEA shared, they had to use our academy, our Hogan's Alley. So I was a cookie cutter in DEA, man, former cop, former D1 football player. Where I'm in there throwing heavyweights around with those dudes, and they're like, what's a big ass country boy like you doing with DEA? Doing with FBI, you should be applying with us. And I tell them, I go, I heard it was harder to get in the FBI. I mean, I still got great friends at DEA and stuff, but yeah. Plus.
And you did come to New York City. You come to 26 Federal Plaza, man.
I forgot. So they tell you to list, you have to list, there's 56 field officers. You have to list them one to 56 in the order you want. It's the most insane thing. It's almost like a mind screw because
they call it the dream sheet.
I think they do it just to mess with you because I'm like, look, man, just tell me to list my top 10, and if you're not giving it to me, you're sending me where you want to anyway. So you sweat over that thing. You wake up in the middle of the night going, I need to put New York higher.
Wait a minute,
Alaska needs to be last. I want to stay on the East Coast. And I think it was like number 36 on my list, and I got it. They told us, they said, we were the last class of the fiscal year. So the fiscal year ends in September, right? We were the last class of the fiscal year, and they told us we were going to get hit with the big five because in 98, they had been loading WFO, Washington Field Office, with new agents because of the Africa embassy bombings. So by the end of the year, your big offices, New York, Chicago, L.A., San Fran, they're screaming going, hey, we need bodies. And they tell you, you have to walk up on orders night. Everybody comes because it's hilarious for a lot of people. And they're all lining the walls. And out of like 50 something new agents in training, I was probably one of the last five to get called up. So I see people get New Orleans. I go, hey man, I had that hire. I see Philadelphia and I go, well, I had that hire in New York. And you have to go up and say, your name, where you're from, what was number one for you, and where do you think you're going? So I walked up and I go, hey, everybody, I'm Scott Payne. I'm from Greenville, South Carolina. I'm like, I think number one was like Jacksonville, Florida or something. I go, where do I think I'm going? I said, well, it hadn't been looking too good for the Southern boys. And I opened it up and I go, New York City. So it's orders night. So you're partying your butt off. And, you know, my party starts with like, I'm going to New York City. Woo, I'm going to New York City by like 1 in the morning. I'm like,
New I'm York, New don't York. Do it.
And then there was like a National Academy going on. So there were NYPD, you know, lieutenants, higher ups there. So they're like, you know, with your awesome New York accent, they're like, you're going to New York. And they're like, what do you drive? I go, a standard cab, stick shift, 4x4 truck. And they go, well, you're not going to drive that up there. And they go, you got any pay? I go, yeah, I got a Basset Hound. Well, you can't call. I said, watch me. So I moved to North Bergen. Jersey, right on the cliff. I mean, I'd walk out at night, let the dog take a leak. Back then, I'd smoke a cigarette every now and then. I'd be smoking a cigarette, and I'd watch the lights cut off on the top of the Empire State Building because I was just north. It was beautiful sky view.
Yo, it's gorgeous up there. Were you partying or anything in New York? Where were your haunts? Oh, yeah. Where were you hanging out in New York?
Off the wagon.
Oh, McDougal Street, baby, and down the hatch on West 4th Street.
Off the wagon. There was one. Was it Turtle Bay? It was an old an old fire department, and the fire guy owned it.
Turtle Bay. Wow, those are on 33rd Street. Yeah, East 33rd Street, I believe, over there.
Yeah, I did that. Those were some go-tos for sure. I'll tell you what, I was a damn pre-9/11, I was a damn good tour guide because once I learned my way and you had the placard, you had to have the placard.
Oh, home run, the key to the city.
Bro, people would come visit me, and I'm like, I'd already befriended the security guys at Empire State Building, just doing what I do, connecting with people. So we'd walk in, I'd go to the security booth, and I'd be like, hey, is Phil here? They're like, hey, come in, separate elevator bank.
Right to the top. Oh, my God, it's great.
I remember my mom, she goes, my ears just popped a lot. And I go, yeah, we just went 80 floors. She's like, 80 floors? And then we'd walk out. Walk through the velvet rope, go up another one, right to the top. We'd go during the day, look at everything, and then we'd come back at night so everybody could see the lights.
Now, you mentioned 98. Were you here for 9/11 then?
I was assigned to New York, but day – I saw my stuff behind me.
I see the
– Yeah, that's that. I mean, look at that mask. I mean, bless our hearts. It's a wonder everybody didn't get a bad disease. I mean, you can't mow your lawn with that thing. But, yeah, that's the riot helmet right there. the day of 9/11, I was undercover in San Antonio, Texas. But as soon as I could fly commercially, I came back. But my transfer was kind of already in process. So my boss, who was the acting ASAC at the time, that ran, he ran the command post, Joe D. He ran the thing. He said, "Look," he said, "Scott, go out there, country." They call me Big Country too. He's like, "Go out there, cover leads. Do as much work as you want. Don't take over anything or you'll lose your transfer." He said, the transfer's in process. So I went and I worked a lot of leads. I went down there. I think there's a picture in the book of standing on the West Side Highway. Because, I mean, it was only emergency vehicles, but you had locals or civilians that lived in the area and they would go out and be, "We love you. We support you," kind of thing. It's crazy. Crazy.
Let me ask you, living here for a little while, you felt more of a connection then too, because you were here and you were a New Yorker then. You're working here.
Oh, absolutely.
In New York.
Yeah.
And then you fly back in. You really felt like a connection to the city more than anything, right?
Dude, I was at World Trade Center at least once a week. Because back then we would clone the beepers. The beepers were big, right? So we would go to like Motorola or whatever it was in World Trade Center. I'd go in there, clone the beeper. And then that way, I was on the Colombian drug squad. So when they're, you know, Washington Heights, when they're getting theirs, I'm getting the same thing they're getting, and I'm having to figure out the code. And I was pretty good at it. So they were like, "Hey, the next case would come up," and they'd be like, "Hey, Country did real good with that. Let him run that again." So kind of get pigeonholed, but it was awesome, man. I'm telling you, when I got there, I was single. Me and my now wife were on a break.
Unfortunately, I'm so sorry.
As friends say, "Hey, we were on a break," you know, which was also one of my tour spot guides. We'd pull up and I go, "There's the outside of the building for the beginning of Friends. There's the restaurant for Seinfeld." You know, it hit all the hot spots.
I loved it, bro.
Go to Carmine's. I'd take everybody to Carmine's.
Of course.
That was before I knew about Tony D's, but I'd go to Carmine's.
I work in my unit with a few guys who are legit under here. The thing that people don't realize is that it's a different ID card for you. It's a different life for you. A lot of them didn't even tell most of their families. When you were under, legit under, obviously your wife knew at the time. Did many other people know that you were under what you were doing or no?
No. I mean, look at me, though. I walk in and I say I'm an FBI agent and I've got tattoos everywhere, a full beard down to my nipples or something. It's like, it's like what? You know, even if I put a suit on, I look like I'm a Hell's Angel on trial or something, you know?
It's a great line.
They're like, or I walk into the office with a suit on, they're like, "Is there a funeral today? Are you all right?" You know? But I didn't like put it out there. But I also, my circle's really tight. It was my Christ following friends. It might be my small group. But like when I was undercover in San Antonio, that's the one classified case. It's not declassified yet. It's pretty much out there. It's part of everybody's InfoSec espionage training every year. It's referenced in there. But I'm not saying it because I don't want to be pulled back in and put in on the box, but like I didn't tell her everything, but she knew I was a security guard in some type of a warehouse because she would come visit me while we were dating. And I mean, in my hotel room is the security uniform and stuff, but yeah. And I'm like, when I was, I shared more with my wife. Again, I'm a transparent guy. And that's just how our family works. I'm sure there would be a lot of people at the FBI that would be like, operational security wise, you can't. I'm like, yeah, but there's also the same jack wagons that have one case and they tell everybody,
The whole world.
I can't talk to anybody. We go, if I tell you, I got to kill you. This is some high class. I'm like, bro, you come in at 9:30, you read the paper for 2 hours, you go get a coffee for 2 hours, you take a 2 hour lunch, a 3 hour workout, you type one piece of paper and you're gone by four. I'm like, I was a cheap date for the FBI. I got paid the same amount as that other person I just referenced, but I was working like 80 hour plus weeks,
Looking back now, the same way everyone we meet, oh, 20 years ago it was better, this and that. I always think now about undercovers, and you, for example, too. Everyone can have a quick story. The same way when I would travel 15 years ago and I'd meet a girl in Amsterdam, I would give her some bullshit story. I have tattoos that I used to fight in UFC. She couldn't Google me or anything. Now, for example, me, if I'm down in California, if I'm in California and I want to do some undercover shit, oh yeah, I went to school in Brooklyn. Dude, all they can do is Google you. Oh, what school did you go to? What was the mascot? Do you ever think about that? How much more difficult it is now? Like back then with your story and shit. Because like right now, quick, oh, you grew up in Brooklyn? Yeah. What school did you go to? Boom, I would. What was the mascot? They would Google you in a second. Isn't that
Well, it's
weird?
just
Like
like,
how it's tough
no, it's just,
now.
but it's just like, I mean, it was still that way before I retired. So I might pick a school that got closed. And I knew of one in South Carolina. It's no longer there.
Oh shit.
There are no yearbooks, but it would have been there when I would have went. So, I mean, but those are things you got to think about. I mean, like even like a lot of these one percenter clubs or gangs, it's like applying for a job. They do a background check. So who's going to vouch for you? Or you go to a rural area and you pop up as someone's friend. His wife grew up with him. How the hell she ain't never heard about me? So now we got to tell her who I really am. Maybe get her on the books. And of course, greed's going to win. They're going to want money too. So it's very hard. And especially the big thing now is that facial recognition stuff. I mean, when they start that whole face ID stuff, man, at one point I had, as Scott Calloway, I had four different states driver's license. You could do it then. I mean, I was Scott Calloway, Oklahoma, Scott Calloway, Tennessee, Scott Calloway, South Carolina, Scott Calloway, Texas. You can't do that. You're not going to be able to do it anymore. Imagine if you went overseas. Imagine, and I could have, luckily I didn't. But imagine had I flown over back then to England, and I get the whole facial recognition, and now I'm retired, and I go back as Scott Payne, and it goes, and I'm like, yeah, but I'm retired. I mean, I'm getting secondary, and I'm sure if I call the FBI, they're gonna be like, you're on your own. You
I
pissed
gotta
half of
ex
us off,
Your most famous case, I guess famous that people talk about the most is the Outlaws case, of course. We're not gonna dive into it. Like I said, you and Rogan, you and Dax, you guys did it perfectly. The book is even better with describing it. Isn't it cliche? Are you ever worried? Like, it seems like it's the oldest trick in the book. FBI guy, undercover cop, long hair, beard, tattoos is gonna infiltrate. Like, it just seems like, shouldn't they be more aware of it?
Yeah, well, a lot of them are, and that's why it's harder, and that's why I got scrutinized like I did. But at the end of the day, it's your legend. Like you're talking about what you're talking about, we call it the legend. So, especially for deep undercover, I need to be able to back up my high school story. If somebody says they were in jail, like you're like, oh shit, all right, okay, I need to go to that jail, or I need to call somebody who works at that jail. I don't even know what the color of the walls are. Hey, where were you? I was in the C block. Okay. You ever go out in general pop? Yeah, man. Okay. Hey, what about that one tree everybody hung out under? Oh yeah, I remember that tree. I was lying. It's just like I went and I may or may not have said I was locked up somewhere. But you find out, like, if you can find out a story, like, hey, man, it's just nonchalant. I'm in the jail and I see all these Chick-fil-A bags, and I'm like, bro, you feed the population here at this county jail Chick-fil-A? They're like, oh, hell no. And I go, well, what's all the Chick-fil-A bags? Oh, well, Chick-fil-A always sends us extra bags over, and we put our sandwiches in them. And I go, well, number one, that's pretty damn cruel, because I think that I'm getting ready to get a Chick-fil-A sandwich, and I open it up, and I've got government bread with, you know, like peanut butter bologna or something, you know? I said, number two, it's pretty damn smart for Chick-fil-A, because as soon as I get out of jail, I'm going to Chick-fil-A.
You're I've been dying for it.
I've been craving it. You know, but that's the story you can tell, and you go, that's real. You go, man, you ain't gonna believe what the hell they do at this jail. And it's a real story.
Yeah.
But what I'll say is, there's a lot out there on what people can and can't do when you're undercover. It's just, do you trust me or not? And greed usually wins. And it's all about how the story I lay out. Like, if on the street level stuff, if I'm going and buying, like I did for the sheriff's office, if I'm going and buying maybe two buys, three buys, whatever it is, and we hit it with a search warrant, am I hanging out with you for days? Do you know my whole backstory? No. Can I say, oh, I can't do that with you tonight, I'm picking up my kids tomorrow, or I got to get piss tested? I can come up with something. But deep undercover, if I came in as a drug user and you haven't seen me use drugs in a month, get ready.
Were you addicted to the work? Because undercover guys I've met, I've talked to, I've worked with, they do a case, maybe 6 months to a year on ICE, mentally decompress. It seemed like you went bang, bang, bang. Were you addicted to the work, to the adrenaline?
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems that way, man.
Yeah, I had the bug, man. But see, I wasn't just an undercover. That's kind of a misconception.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of hard to paint it in the book because it's an undercover book. But there was only like twice in my career that I was listed as full-time undercover.
Oh, okay.
Other than that, I had to be a case agent at my office for my squad, for my supervisor. And I always tried to be above average. So I'm having to develop my own sources, run my own cases. I might be training an agent. I might be running the squad when the boss is gone. I was running all the tactical and firearms training for McAllen and Brownsville in Texas. I was on SWAT, and I might be doing two undercovers at the same time, but I love doing more than one thing. And, I was eating it up, man. And to my detriment, as I say in the book, at one point I did do the Ric Flair face plant. I'm good. Bam. I'm like, no, I'm not good. I need to take a break.
You mention your faith all the time. My faith is very important to me as well. And it always gets overlooked. Let's be honest, Scott, that's not a good story. Like, oh, I was undercover with the outlaws. My faith is huge. Okay. Your faith being so huge, was it ever a conflict to you being in these situations, or did you use your faith as a crutch? Like, holy shit, I'm in these situations. I need my guy to protect me. Was it like, I'm always curious about that with you.
It's what helped me through it. That's what helped me through it. And my wife came up with this term, and I was like, why didn't you think of that before we did the book, man? Because she's like, you're always talking about undercover, you're undercover. She goes, really, you were under his cover. And I went, oh.
What damn. A great line. That's I'm a like, great holy, line.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was like, dadgummit. But and you know, even at times when I didn't know it, and that's going back to the first chapter one, messing around with Satanism and devil worshiping and all that stuff, I was covered and I didn't know it. And you know, not trying to preach to everybody can do their own thing, but I had the Jesus scared back into me, and I never had a problem after that.
Yeah.
as far as devil worshiping went, I'm like, all right, I'm good.
We're Jesus smiling. Locked me back in.
Yeah. But later on in life, I go to a satanic concert festival, and I work in our line of work. You deal with some of the most evil things and
evil people. Yes.
You're staring at evil in the face. So, you know, that's always helped me. And then my small groups, like at my church, that's, and I'll tell you, a lot of people don't know this. I think it might be in the acknowledgement section of the book, but when we as a team, the Brooklyn Literary, we picked the co-writer, Michelle, which is funny because she claims that she's a liberal Canadian journalist who's agnostic. I joke with her and tell her it's a cop-out. She's like, what do you mean it's a cop-out? I said, just go ahead and say you're atheist. Don't tell me, well, I believe, but I don't know in what. I'm like, come on. Get off the fence.
Yeah. Make a decision.
Commit. Because if I'm right and you're wrong when we die, I said, but if you're right and I'm wrong when we die, you know, I'm like, eh, did I have a bad life? No. When we were interviewing publications, pitching to publications, it was Simon & Schuster, and Amar Dial was the editor pretty much through the entire book process. Okay. And then he took a job somewhere else. And then Yaniv came in and closed the deal. But it was Amar doing a Zoom call, and in the pitch, somewhere in there, it was like once about my faith. And Amar is the one that said, hey, I picked up on your faith in this pitch. He goes, is that something that happened later in life, or is that something through your whole life? I go, no, that's through my entire life. And he goes, I would like to see that throughout the entire book. Mm-hmm. And I remember, Mike, when I closed the laptop from that Zoom, I looked up and I went, well, that was different. That was different, because everybody else was kind of like, you know, well, I really just want to talk about white supremacy. Yeah. Nobody picked up on the faith or anything. And that's been a huge thing for me.
Yeah, I was always wondering if you were conflicted by doing the things that you had to put yourself in situations with and go home and, like, maybe you do your prayers, go to church, like, wow, I was just in some heavy, evil stuff here. It must be like a roller coaster of emotions for you, too.
Sometimes, but yeah. I tried to ground myself in that, even through all this, like this whole being on the road for 3 months. I've tried to book in my big, like, I book in because I'm a musician and a singer, and I play at my mega church. You know, I'm like, they're like, hey, can you do this Sunday? Yes. I'm flying out Monday. I come back. Can you do this Sunday? Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, my wife's like, hey, aren't you tired? I'm like, yeah, but I'm bookending this whole thing with the church, man. And it helped keep me grounded. And I might not be able to share everything, I might be able to say, hey, you know, to my whatever you want to call it, small group, life group, whatever it is, your close group of Christian friends, I might be able to say, hey, man, I'm going through a tough time, you know, and, you know, pray over me. I'll tell you, after that whole goat weekend and all that stuff, I was like, I didn't feel right.
Dirty, right?
Yeah. I felt, I was like, I need to go, you know, like the scene in the movie, like, you know, give me a loofah. I got to exfoliate. I got to get this stuff off of me. But, I remember texting my pastor. I was like, hey man, I know it's hard, especially for guys sometimes. Or type A's to reach out. I'm like, I could use a little prayer, man. I feel weird after that one. But, yeah, sometimes. But even like, look at my history. Like, I used to bounce in strip clubs. Mm-hmm. So did that help me in the Outlaws case? Absolutely. I'm not falling in love with a stripper. I know. I mean, I'm not putting it down strippers.
No, of course not.
You do your own thing. But I'm like, I'm not falling in love. You know, the guys, I mean, it's like, oh, she doesn't dance like that for anybody else but me. I'm like, yes, she does. She loves me. Did you pay for it? I'm just saying, it's a business, you know, but because those have happened, that we've had that too. Like, a person comes in, they're undercover. Maybe they're not certified, but they got approved to do the undercover. And you find out that on their own, they were trying to build their bona fides by going to a strip club, which had nothing to do with the undercover they were on. And of course, they fall in love. And then they end up telling the stripper, I'm actually an undercover FBI agent here. Not good. Not good. Can't do it.
One thing about law enforcement now, you and I have both been doing it for 20 something years now. I know you're retired and stuff, but you're always in the game. Biggest change you've seen, better or worse, in the last 20 something years?
Oh, it's I mean, that's a pretty easy answer. If you're in our line of work, that pendulum has swung to the whole defund the police, anti-police. And that's why I'm trying, like I'm still an alert instructor, right? Yeah. Alert's the national standard for training law enforcement and active shooter response. At the end of the week, you know, if one of the other instructors in our goodbyes doesn't say it, I'll jump on it. And I always say, look, do me a couple of favors, man. Number one, I know it's hard. Number one, thank you for being on the wall, because I'm not actively bonded anymore. If my buddy wins sheriff, there's a slight chance I may be bonded again. Even if
it's your wife's going to kill you. Yeah.
Well, maybe I could just round it out to a nice 30 years.
I like it.
But I'm not on the wall anymore. So thank you for doing what you do. Don't tarnish the badge. All it takes is one or two and the rest of us pay. Even if it was good and it looks bad optically, you know, and do the right thing. Yeah. I know you took an oath, and I know I'm not out there getting spit in my face, and I don't know if I could do it. Cause if somebody spits in my face, I'm going to use the right level of force. Trust me, but you're not going to get away with spitting in my face. But at the end of the day, I try to tell people, We took an oath. It is a servant's heart. It's a shepherd's mentality. We are here to serve and protect, and our official title is a peace officer, right? So do the right thing, even if, and look, a lot of times I'd much rather throat punch somebody than to do the right thing, because I'm like, oh, I want to smash this dude so bad, but I'm like, but I'm going to do the right thing, because it's the right damn thing to do, you know? And then I get into the mental health aspect, you know, and just take care of yourself. Don't feel weak. It's not weak if you need help, you know, and screw everybody that's standing behind you telling you you're a wuss, because you need it. And if you need it, then you do it, you know? So those are things I kind of push to try to, I don't know. So that's the big thing. I think things have swung so far. Yeah. And luckily, thankfully, on a huge scale, it didn't take a catastrophic event, which is usually what it takes. Something very bad, very big, very publicized for everybody to go, holy shit, how did we get here? Let's swing the pendulum back. I think this, the pendulum's swinging back. I'm seeing it in the FBI. I'm not in it, so I don't know. I know there's a lot of people that are my friends in the FBI. They're worried about their jobs and stuff. But from where I'm looking, it looks like there's a lot more people being arrested, and people are getting less of the administrative burdens and more of the freedom to go work,
which
and
is what they want to do. The morale seems higher,
and a force of the law. Yeah.
And I always love this before we finish up. When you talk to people, it's like, no, morale's getting higher. Oh, why? They're letting us do work. And it's like, oh, so you guys don't like when you tell people like, no, morale's really good. Oh, why so? They're letting us go out there and get bad guys and do work. It's like, oh, that's really, no one wants to be inside. That always blows my mind. Like, we want to work.
I know. And then picture this, depending on where you're working, like Austin, they had a very liberal DA there. I think he's still there. At one point, like, that dude was going back like 6 years and pulling use of force reports. At one point, I think like 35 active officers were under indictment, and they're still going to work. Can you imagine what it would be like to be a law enforcement officer indicted? And why would I go do my job? I'm still saying my oath is probably going to make me do it, but that's when you start getting those proverbial, hey, man, it's me and you. Hey, Mike, hey, we got an armed robbery in progress. All right, Scott and Mike, we'll take it. All right, so, Mike, anyway, tell me about that. What happened this weekend?
Yeah,
you know,
I
and
know,
then it's
I
like,
know.
We'll go, and that's what happens. Or picture you're somewhere where the mayor is telling you to hold the line. No retaliation whatsoever, and you're taking bricks to the face. That's deadly force. You could kill somebody. If we're not going to be allowed to do our job, then, and I'm not saying come in as a brute.
No, never.
You know, I'll sit down and talk with people all day long and be like, hey, you know what? The old Scott Payne would have been like, you're a dumbass. Go back to your house and stay in your bubble. But I've learned that doesn't do a whole lot of good, because since I've retired, and especially in this realm, I deal with a lot of people. Like, the majority of people I deal with, especially in entertainment, are more left of center, and that's fine. But if they say, why can't you just shoot somebody in the leg? You know, I'll be like, you know, that's a great question. There's something called the force continuum, the deadly force continuum. And I'll start explaining it. I'm talking highfalutin attorneys. I was at the Eradicate Hate Global Summit in Pittsburgh, and I'm talking somebody that is a well-known defense attorney. And they said it, and I said, you've never heard of the force continuum, the deadly force continuum? They're like, no. And I was like, well, let me explain it to you. And as I explained, I said, we can't, if we pull a gun out, it's because it has escalated to a deadly force situation. And we don't shoot the maim. That would be a liability lawsuit. We're here to stop the killing. Or to prevent a killing.
Stop the threat, yes.
Yeah, we're going to eliminate the threat. And I just try to spread knowledge. And I've learned a lot, bro. I mean, I've...
Well, because you listen. And that's why I love watching your interviews and stuff. Because you listen. My whole thing is listen to me explain, like, oh, I never realized. Once you listen, you're obtaining more knowledge. And as long as the other person listens, that's the whole dialogue we want.
Buddy, I can waffle in 2 seconds. You know what I mean? I'll lay out my whole thing, and I'll be like, this is why, and this is why. And I lay it out, and you go... Yeah, but here's this piece of information. And I go, well, based on that piece of information, I completely go against what I just said. I did not know that. And I'm going to agree with you now. You know,
Scott, I've had you on. I've had you on for an hour. We're ready to finish up with some quick hit questions.
Hit me.
You and I are at a bar here in New York City, maybe right off the wagon, knocking down some beers. Who's the coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you back? You want to impress everyone in the bar. Who are you texting that's going to text you back?
Maybe Tim Sylvia former UFC heavyweight champion.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Super heavyweight slap champion right now. Which, by the way, he says, "Hey, you want to slap each other?" I said, "No." I'm like,
"That's
I'll
a good
fight
answer."
You.
I thought you were going to say Kane. That's a good answer.
Well, Glenn Jacobs was first in my head, but yeah, that maybe AJ Styles, WWE.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Some people like that. Yeah.
Best law enforcement show or movie? Usually we don't like them. Favorite one?
Well, I can still watch cheesy ones and love it though. See, I'm at movie. I'm probably still going to go like some undercover,
okay,
cheesy man. It's a cult classic for me, man. Brian Bosworth, Stone Cold, Undercover as a Biker. Maybe Charlie Sheen, Beyond the Law. Right after that, yeah, I love those, man. Departed's great. It's just long.
Great long movie. That's, yeah, it's a big commitment. 3 a.m. You finish up a gig in Tennessee. You come home. What's your go to meal at 3 a.m.?
A Jack and Coke. have I had a gummy yet or not? If I had a gummy, it's probably gonna be some ice cream. No, go to meal for late night. I'll tell you what. There's this granola called Love Crunch. It's peanut butter, dark chocolate granola. I put that in a cup with a little bit of Silk almond milk, and there, yeah, that's probably it.
You said you're a rom-com guy, but last show you binge watched doesn't have to be a hardcore cop show. Last show you binge watched?
I just finished Yellowstone, and I just started Tulsa King.
Good or no?
Oh yeah, yeah, I loved Yellowstone. Yeah, oh, that was good.
My wife watches that.
Yeah, solid. But every time I watch a show, I want to move to Montana.
No. Give me what's coming up next for you. What do you got? I know you're doing podcasts up the ash. You're all over the place. What do you got coming up? And part two is has your book been optioned for a documentary or a movie or a show or anything yet?
That's what's next in the running. I will say that we got a lot more pitches after the Rolling Stones article, but Hollywood is completely different now.
Yeah.
It's really weird. Everybody, I mean, to do an unscripted documentary, it's a no-brainer. There's a lot of people out there chomping at the bit. But if you do that, you have to sign a shopping agreement. So that shopping agreement might look like for a year to a year and a half, I can do anything with my bookstore, all my stories, except for, let's say, the Outlaws.
Yeah, I know.
And then if somebody comes in and wants to option the whole book, that hurts the sale. So we're moving slowly. Hollywood's moving slowly, but I actually have a call today in 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's why we moved the podcast up, so you can hang out that call.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm hoping for that. I mean, I'm fine with. I just want to succeed. I just want to, just like the music industry, I would like to get something out there, even if I'm just a consultant. That's fine. But if nothing happens, man, I've been blessed. It's been cool. There's several avenues. There's like they're talking like, don't go back. Because I have another book in me that's all case agent stuff.
Okay.
Where I've run undercovers and then things like, I mean, you know, the 3 days tracking phones and rescuing a 5-year-old girl out of a stash house and on the border, you know, those are some great, great happy ending, heart wrenching things. But what I'm being told by all of my contacts, agents, literary agents, publicists, is if you've already got a New York Times bestselling autobiography, don't do another one. Just go fiction. And I'm like, well, we'll see. It's up in the air. If not, maybe I'll bond back in. Maybe I start gigging on the corner, playing some songs with a bucket in front of me.
Last two, you keep bringing up music, musicians. One person you want to jam with, if you can be on stage with anyone, who is it?
Alive right now.
Yeah.
Marcus King.
Who?
Marcus King. He's a blues guy. He's a blues guy.
I have no idea who that is. That's why I said
you got to check him out, Mark. There's so many good bands out there. I mean, I was blessed enough to be invited to a private concert with Randy Houser and Lee Bryce. Lee Bryce is a Clemson grad. And that was just those two on acoustics. Something like that, I would freaking love, man. You know what? All right. I want to change my answer.
All right, I'll let you change it.
I'm thinking musician, like jamming with Marcus King or somebody like that would be unbelievable. But Zach Wilde is always a favorite. I play a Zach Wilde Les Paul, but I'm going to say Jamie Johnson, man. If I could get on stage with somebody and jam.
Just rock out.
Maybe Jamie, Randy, Lee Bryce, that whole little crew right there, man. They all know each other. That would be some drinking and having a good time.
And the most important question is, who plays you in a movie? You got that sexy face. Who's playing you in a movie?
Man, I don't see. I went through this a little bit with the Rolling Stones pitch.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember there was a guy, he's pretty famous, and they were like, man, he really wants to do this. And I was like looking at him going, I could see him doing this case, but he couldn't be the, I'm not even there anymore. Any ego I had, which I shouldn't have had in the first place, is gone. I just want to succeed. I mean, clearly it could be somebody, they don't have to be big and muscular, but in a perfect world, I would like to have a series where it's like kind of The Wire, which is one of the most accurate, cool shows that was done law enforcement wise. The Wire meets like Son of Anarchy meets like Breaking Bad, because you have that core that's the same, but every season's a new case, maybe. But man, I don't know. I mean, I'm going back and forth with Jai Courtney on Instagram
That's
after he saw
sick.
me on Rogan. I'm
So
like,
sick.
he would be good.
The I'll make you laugh at The Wire. It's like my one name drop. Michael K. Williams, Omar, was one of my closest friends, came to my wedding and everything, and I never watched The Wire. Is that crazy? I never
I
watched The
know, it's
Wire. He used
cool.
to give me shit. He's like, bro, how'd you ever watch my show? So that's always my Michael K. Williams story.
It's really good, but it goes back to when the early day, well, early days for me, when we're doing wiretaps and it's the pay
The
phones and you got
pager,
to
I
go
heard,
hit the
right?
phone. Yeah. And you got, man, I was like, it's legit. I was like, man, this is a
I'm
solid
gonna
show.
watch it because I know guys I work with are like, bro, they talk about overtime and comp stat. You gotta watch it. So
Oh yeah.
I'll commit to it.
And the wire process, it's not like most TVs, like, oh, I need to be on that phone in 5 minutes. I mean, maybe track a phone for the sniper, but not like tapping it to listen. I'm like, we're talking 80-page affidavits and,
Highlighting.
oh man.
Scott, give the plugs where anyone can find you on social media. Not that you need it. You were on Joe Rogan, you
No,
were
man.
everywhere else. Where can they find you? Obviously, the book is Codenamed Pale Horse, How I Went Undercover to Expose America's Nazis. Best-selling book. The book is unreal, and I don't read cop books. One of the best books I've read, the roller coaster with relationships and high school and everything else in between. Edge of your seat reading it, bro. It was insane, and I love you for coming on, but just give the plug where everyone can find you.
Instagram, LinkedIn, X, they're all at Scott Payne Big Country. PAYNE. At Scott Payne Big Country. Pale Horse was already taken. So, but yeah, hit me up, man. I get inundated a good bit. I'm like, all right, I got to put the phone down. I need an assistant, but I don't have the money for an assistant yet. So
Well, we started out meeting in the bathroom, and look where we ended up, bro. Listen, next time you're in the Big Apple, seriously, we'll text each other, we'll link up, we'll do some cool shit, get some good food, bro. Thank you for doing this. I hope I made it a little different and it
you
wasn't just
did.
repeating the stories. Hope you enjoyed this, man.
No, I did. Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Bro, I love you, man. Be safe, have fun, and thanks again for coming on, bro.
Love you too, and right back, man.
Chat soon, man. God bless you.
Later.